America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to apply the rules of science, not just to some of the most important questions in life, but even to Holly Weird. That's right. It is our Science and Culture Hour with Discovery Institute. I have Stephen Meyer, the author of the bestseller, triumphant bestseller, Darwin's Doubt, is in studio with me and ready to take a look at the science of gravity. That doesn't mean just the Newtonian law of gravity, but the science behind the motion picture Gravity, which is a front runner for various Oscar nominations, one of the most successful movies of the year. And a pretty good movie starring Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. George Clooney, one of the producers. It's a movie about something that could maybe kind of sort of happen to American astronauts in space. Steve, great to see you again, and thanks for coming in.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Did you enjoy the film as much as I did?
I did. I watched it last night, and I came out very grateful that my feet were on terra firma.
Absolutely. And your feet are on terra firma because of?
The force of gravity. Yeah.
Okay. Now, Discovery Institute is, according to critics, your Center for Science and Culture, of which you're the director, denies basic science. Do you have any problems with the law of gravity?
Well, no, but there are some very interesting and deep questions that the whole phenomenon of gravity raises. And that was one of you had the idea for this show, and I thought it was a great idea because it's a place where your interests in film and our interests in science actually intersect. And I had a chance when I was a grad student in Cambridge to work with an historian of physics who gave a fascinating series of lectures on the debate about universal gravitation when it was first proposed by Newton. And it turns out there are a lot of really mysterious things about gravity, not only Newton's version of it, but the more current version as proposed by Einstein. But the biggest mystery associated with gravity is the whole question of what causes it. I used to do an illustration in class where I would pick up a book or a wallet and I would drop it and ask the class, what caused that object to fall to the earth? The students would say, well, it was gravity. But then I would ask them, well, what is gravity? And we would often go round and round and eventually come to an answer like, well, gravity is the tendency for unsupported objects to fall, or gravity is that an attraction between two pieces of mass. But then that raised the question, what causes that attraction? What causes this unsupported body separated in space from another body to move? The moon exerts a force on the tides, on the water on the earth, but the moon is 238,900 miles away. How is that force transmitted through empty space? That's how the film Gravity actually started, was the discussion. The lines on the screen came up saying, you know, out in space, there's no matter to transmit sound. There's nothing to impede motion. So how is force being transmitted through that empty space? That was a profound mystery that Newton confronted. He described gravitational attraction, the force of gravity, more accurately with his mathematical equation. But he was very clear that he did not actually propose, he did not have an explanation, a material explanation for the cause. There was no pushing, no pulling, no interaction between moon and earth, and yet the two bodies separated in space were clearly affecting each other.
Okay, they clearly do affect one another. And part of what the movie is about is we kind of think, well, wouldn't it be neat to be up there where there is no gravity? But in this particular film, it becomes rather scary.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, okay, just to talk about the movie first and then to some of the deeper questions. In terms of the film, there's one aspect of this film that people say is just unrealistic, and without giving away too much, did you note that as well, along with a lot of the other commentators?
Well, I ran into some friends going in who said they had a friend who was actually in the space program who had walked out because he thought it was so unrealistic. I personally have never been in space, so I was willing to suspend disbelief and enjoy the very realistic feeling of being suspended in zero G.
Okay, I think what they were suggesting was that at one point the astronauts who get in trouble because of a bunch of space junk floating through. All of that could happen. Mm-hmm. And again, my late father, who you knew, was in the
physicist, yeah,
right, absolutely. And was in the space program, the astronaut program, for some time. And a lot of it's very realistic. I mean, there could be a bunch of space junk that comes and hits astronauts while they're in the middle of a spacewalk, which is what this movie really is about. The part that apparently is unrealistic is that there is a great distance between where the International Space Station is in terms of how far away it is and where these astronauts were supposed to be. It's not realistic that you could, using your jetpacks or your rocket-propelled packs, travel that entire distance.
Yeah, sure, that makes sense.
And, okay, so having now not given too much away from the movie, I hope, because it is a mind-boggling film. And it's kind of amazing to see in 3D. Did you see it in 3D?
I did.
Okay, in terms of the law of gravity, when people are in space, and they are not really falling in one direction or another, does that say that there is a distance at which gravity no longer operates?
Well, no. The idea of gravity is that it is universal. It operates everywhere. And in Newton's version of it, it was a force that was transmitted through a distance between two massive bodies. So the force of gravity is inversely proportional to the distance between them. And it's directly proportional to the size of the bodies. But there is always some amount of gravitational force being exerted. Einstein's version of gravity has massive bodies causing a curvature of space, which in turn constrains or the motions of bodies. But it's also operating everywhere, albeit in some cases at very, very weak levels.
Why should we care about it?
Well, the thing that's so fascinating to me about the whole debate about gravity, and maybe I go back to the story, because there's a fascinating story about Newton proposing this universal law of gravity. It was immediately pilloried by the leading scientists in the day. One was Gottfried Leibniz, the German mathematician, who was
the co-originator of the calculus.
Of the calculus, so no slouch. And Leibniz characterized Newton's law as bringing the occult into science. He said it was a vague and chimerical notion, strong words. And what was bothering Leibniz was that there was no physical, no material cause for gravitational action. There was no pushing and pulling, no interaction between the bodies involved. The moon and the earth, again, are not touching each other. And he thought that that Newton was guilty of one of two things. Either he was bringing an occult, unexplained entity into science, or he was subtly, in other words, he didn't have a material explanation, or he was subtly bringing God into science as an immaterial explanation for gravity.
And Newton, of course, was a very deeply committed believer.
He was a devout Christian, also, you know, and he had a profoundly theistic understanding of science. And Newton officially, because he was kind of cornered by Leibniz, officially said, yes, hypothesis non fingo, which in Latin means I don't feign to know the cause. So Leibniz confronted him with a dilemma. Either you don't have a cause, or subtly you're saying God is the cause. But actually, Newton did believe that God was the ultimate cause of all the fundamental laws of force, or all the fundamental laws of physics. The laws of physics, in particular the law of gravity, has this strange structure where we don't know what gravity is, we just know what it does.
Do we have a better physical explanation for gravity now?
Well, many physicists would argue that we do, and I would agree that Einstein's theory of general relativity is a theory of gravity, and it has some advantages over Newtonian gravity. It describes the phenomenon better, but it still has this fundamentally mysterious element in that we replace forces with fields in Newtonian gravity, or in Einsteinian gravity. But a field is also an entity which is defined operationally by what it does. We don't really know what the field is. We say it's a massive body causes a curvature of space which constrains motions. But exactly how is what is a curved space? And again, there's no actual material thing causing the motions. So the gravity is something, and this is one of the things I loved about the film, is that we take it for granted, because granted we walk around and we're glad to have our feet on the earth. Sometimes we're not so happy when we fall as a result of it. But the film really took the viewer out of the space in which we are familiar and allowed us to think about something that's really quite mysterious.
We will be right back with Dr. Stephen Meyer on the issue of gravity, both the film and the force. Meanwhile, if gravity is such a force drawing large bodies together, how does a Big Bang theory work? I mean, would that have to be a heck of a bang? We're told, according to the Big Bang theory, that heavenly bodies are moving further and further away from each other. Shouldn't they be moving closer according to gravitational attraction? We'll get to that and more with Dr. Stephen Meyer, our Science and Culture Hour on the MedVet Show. Your call's coming up.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael MedVet Show.
Beautiful, don't you think?
What?
The sunrise.
Terrific.
No! Explorer's been hit. Explorer, do you read? Do you copy?
Yes, I copy. I'm detached.
Give me your position.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm spinning. I can't.
Report your position.
GPS is down. I can't.
Give me a visual.
I see nothing.
You have a visual of Explorer.
No.
I need you to focus. Anything. Use the sun and the earth. Give me coordinates.
I can't breathe.
Give me
coordinates. I can't breathe.
Twenty-one minutes after the hour, that part of the soundtrack from the hugely popular and critically praised movie Gravity. It is one of the best movies of the year. It will certainly be on my 10 best list. It is spellbinding, and Sandra Bullock featured there in those clips, along with George Clooney. Both of them considered to be favorites for nominations for more Oscars. George Clooney would be for Best Supporting Actor. Sandra Bullock would be for getting her second Academy Award as Best Actress. She has some formidable competition, of course, so she may not win, but will she get a nomination? Probably. Probably. The movie Gravity, the science of gravity, that our discussion point with Dr. Stephen Meyer in this Science and Culture Hour. Let me say, if you want to join us, not just for the Science and Culture Hour, but for a broadcast of the whole show live, we're going to be broadcasting live from the intergalactic headquarters of the Discovery Institute next week, next Wednesday, special holiday kind of gathering. It will be fun and friendly and free. I believe it's free.
I think so.
No, it is not free. Sorry.
Close to free.
It's close to free. It's a bargain in any event. But go to our website and you can find out about it. If whatever cost is going to be minimal and to defer the cost of the refreshments
and the lunch will
be provided. Because it's at Lunch and Listen. And this at Discovery Institute in downtown Seattle. 1 week from today, you can go to michaelmedved.com and find out all about it. It's terrible to say that something's free when it's not. In any event, you can check it out at our website at michaelmedved.com and join us next week for the live broadcast. Okay, Steve, right before the break, I put a question that I think that occurs to a lot of people. If you know about the Big Bang Theory, and the Big Bang Theory, more than anything else, really made my father a believer. Because if you believe that the entire universe had a beginning, and the beginning was some kind of tiny microscopic bit of matter, and then this exploded with some unimaginable force at some point literally trillions of years ago, and that since that time, all of this matter that came out of that explosion, that initial explosion, has been going further and further apart. How does that conform to gravitation? Because gravitation is supposed to have big bodies like planets and suns and solar systems that actually attract each other because they're drawn to each other. And yet the evidence is pretty clear that the universe is drifting further and further apart, right?
Right. So there is a countervailing force involved in the expansion of the universe, which physicists observe. And in fact, the Big Bang Theory was at first inferred on the basis of the evidence for the expansion of the galaxies. Hubble was one of the main players in that, in observing that the galaxies are expanding, are moving away from us in every direction, and from which he inferred that the universe is expanding, from which he further inferred that if you wind the clock backwards, you eventually get to a beginning point to the expansion, which is the point of the beginning or the creation of the universe. Now, there's a gravity angle on all this, another gravity angle, and that is that additional support for the Big Bang theory came from came as a result of Einstein's theory of gravity. His idea was that gravity is the result, gravitational attraction between massive bodies is the result of the curvature of space. Every massive body curves the space in its immediate vicinity. Then if you think about winding that time clock backwards, as the universe expands outward now, as you go further back in time, all the matter in the universe would be closer and closer and closer.
Just
together.
Try to imagine you're running the documentary footage.
Yes,
that
exactly.
Is unfortunately unavailable.
Yes.
You're running it in reverse.
And you're running it in reverse. Now, then think of what's happening to all those, that the material of the galaxies. They're getting closer and closer and closer together, which is making the curvature of space tighter and tighter and tighter. Now, in 1968, two brilliant British physicists, Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose, solved some equations, what are called the field equations of general relativity. It's part of Einstein's theory. And they showed that if you go back far enough in time, you get to a place where the curvature of space becomes infinitely tight, corresponding to zero spatial volume. So you don't just have a singularity in time, a beginning point in time. You also have a singularity in space where there is effectively no space at the beginning.
So would Thomas Aquinas would describe this as creation ex nihilo.
It's very similar to what the medieval theologians called creation creatio ex nihilo. And in fact, I used to ask my students a question just to get this across. I'd say, how much material stuff can you put in zero spatial volume? It's not really that there's a little cosmic egg waiting to explode.
It's that there's nothing.
There's nothing.
By the way, the Hebrew phrase in biblical Hebrew is yesh me'ayin, from just nothing.
Right. So there are ways that people try to get around that now with something called quantum cosmology, but that has its own set of mysterious, I think actually theistic implications associated with it. So it's really, gravity is not just mysterious because we don't know exactly what is causing it. Our best description of how gravity works from Einstein's theory of general relativity implies that there is this true spatial and temporal singularity at the beginning of the universe, which has, I think, at least a profoundly anti-materialistic implication.
Let's go to Rob in Chicago. Rob, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Stephen Meyer.
Thanks for taking my call. I've actually stumbled onto the Science Hour a lot, I guess when you've had him as a guest, and just two points I wanted to make. The first, I feel like a lot of the arguments really, if you dissect them, kind of boil down to, well, because science can't explain it, therefore maybe it's God or maybe it's intelligent design. And I think, at least that's how they sound, and they don't seem very persuasive. And I guess the other point I would make is that, in general, I think Rabbi Heschel, who said, I'm paraphrasing, science and religion are not meant to answer the same questions, and that a lot of conflict arises when they try to answer questions left to the other field. And so whenever I hear these discussions about...
By the way, I think Stephen Meyer would agree with you.
I think it's science and religion trying to answer each other's questions.
No, I think Dr. Meyer, would you agree with that?
Well, I'd agree largely. I think that what we're talking about really today is a question not of science per se. We all agree about the basics of the law of gravity or Einstein's theory of gravity. The question is really at the margins of science, at the boundaries of science, when we start asking questions, well, what is a law of nature? And physics has this odd structure. This is not really something that physics is ultimately going to overcome. And the structure is that we infer unobservable entities based on the things that we can observe. But those unobservable entities often are themselves immaterial. And so when we want to give a completely materialistic account of things, turns out we can't do it. And it's not really being against science. It's just recognizing the limits of science.
What limits of science and applying to some of the debate over Steve's best-selling book and the question, are we alone in the universe? That and more coming up.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
Four minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, and I was just last night at a great big wonderful party. It was a Hanukkah party. Tonight, the last night of Hanukkah, the eighth night of Hanukkah tonight. So with guests arriving at your place coming up for Christmas, don't you want your home looking its absolute best? Well, you can do that with beautiful custom window coverings for the holidays from Blinds.com. Best source for blind shade shutters and drapes. Hurry, you can take advantage of amazing December deals with 15 to 25% off top brands. Blinds.com, where prices crush home improvement store prices for the holidays. That's Blinds.com. Joined by Stephen Meyer, who is going to tell us in just a moment about crushing the opposition in a debate regarding your book. But your book, Darwin's Doubt, has been a national bestseller, New York Times bestseller list. It has been enormously eye-opening for many people. I mean, I've spoken to people who've read Darwin's Doubt. It's posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com and believe the book has changed their lives. You also got a review, and it wasn't an entirely dismissive review, in the very prestigious journal Science, and then ended up debating the reviewer. Is that right?
Absolutely, and it was a terrific advance, I think, in the discussion. The reviewer is a distinguished paleontologist, Charles Marshall, who is at the University of California, Berkeley, an Aussie, and probably one of the top five Cambrian experts in the world. And so I was delighted to engage the interest of such distinguished scientists in the pages of Science. The review was negative, but it was respectful. And I was really thrilled with it, not only because the book got the attention it did in Science, but also because the reviewer was the first critical reviewer to take head on the main scientific argument of my book. My book argues that the origin of the information, the genetic and other forms of information you need to build the Cambrian animals, is best explained by a purposive intelligence acting in the history of life. What we know from experience is that information always arises from an intelligent source. The origin of the Cambrian animals requires a huge infusion of new information, and therefore intelligent design provides a ready explanation for that, especially in
and light this is not a religious argument. It is a scientific argument.
It's based on both the scientific evidence of the fossil record and the importance of DNA to building animals. So DNA holds all that important digital code. And it's also based on a standard method of scientific reasoning. In fact, the very method of historical scientific reasoning that Charles Darwin pioneered in The Origin of Species. So it's a science-based argument. Marshall had an interesting counter-argument, and he said, well, Meyer is wrong. You don't really need that much new genetic information to build these Cambrian animals. Instead, all you need is to rewire the genetic regulatory circuits that control how pre-existing genes are expressed. Now, I thought that was a really interesting proposal and argument, but I also thought it was question begging, in that to talk about the genetic regulatory circuits being rewired presupposes three sources of unexplained information. First, genetic regulatory circuits are made of genes. Genes encode digital information. That's one source. Secondly, to rewire them would require coordinated mutations in the genome, and that's a big source of information. And then thirdly, Marshall was presupposing a pre-existent, pre-Cambrian, pre-adapted genome that would provide the information for building all the parts of the Cambrian animals. So in order to answer my argument about the need for intelligent design to explain the origin of information, Marshall presupposed but did not explain three separate sources of information. And so even without a PhD in science, I think people can understand that the one of the best evolutionary biologists really doesn't have an answer to this central question of the book.
And you see, this is not, we had a very smart caller, our last caller, who said that science and religion are really meant to answer different questions. And I think to some extent that's largely true. You would agree with that.
I would agree. But this is not a religious argument. This is an argument based on our uniform and repeated experience of what it takes to build information. What we know from experience is that it always takes a mind to generate digital code. And when we find an event in the history of life that requires a big infusion of digital information, it's a reasonable scientific inference to say that a mind played a role.
Or somehow, one thing that science has been unable to explain and hasn't really attempted to explain is how you get something, namely matter, a universe, from nothing, which we were talking about before, creation out of nothing. And we will get to the New York Times seeming to endorse intelligent design. Well, in an editorial, it's unbelievable. Wait till we get to this coming up with Stephen Meyer.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
Forty-four minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of the bestseller Darwin's Doubt. It is available up at our website. Click on the Science and Culture banner at MichaelMedved.com. You can also join us for a live broadcast and lunch at Discovery Institute in downtown Seattle a week from today on Wednesday. That would be the 11th of December. And we will be there. And I'm also going to be speaking at a banquet in Los Angeles the night before on the 10th of December for an organization called Jews for Judaism. And people who want to come to that fundraising banquet, you can find out about that at our website, also at MichaelMedved.com. Okay, Stephen Meyer, I was just stunned to see in the New York Times sometimes I put stuff in the Times away, you know, to look at it later. And I got to this. This actually appeared in November, and it's by a very well-known science writer. He is the director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science at Arizona State University. And his name is Paul Davies, and he has devoted his life to studying life on other planets. Headline here is, Are We Alone in the Universe? And then it says, don't believe the latest hype about life on other planets. That's the subheading. And he writes, when I was a student in the 1960s, the prevailing view among scientists was that life on Earth was a freak phenomenon, the result of a sequence of chemical accidents so rare that they would be unlikely to have happened twice in the observable universe. Man at last knows he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he has emerged only by chance, wrote the biologist Jacques Monod. Today, the pendulum has swung dramatically, and many distinguished scientists claim that life will almost inevitably arise in Earth-like conditions. Yet this decisive shift in view is based on little more than a hunch, rather than an improved understanding of life's origin. And then this, and I thought this, boy, this sounds like my friend Steve Meyer. He writes, the underlying problem is complexity. Even the simplest bacterium is, at the molecular level, staggeringly complex. Although we have no idea of the minimal complexity of a living organism, it is likely to be very, very high. It could be that some sort of complexifying principle operates in nature, serving to drive a chaotic mix of chemicals on a fast track to a primitive microbe. If so, no hint of such a principle has been found in laboratory experiments to recreate the basic building blocks of life. You ready to invite him to Discovery Institute?
Well, I've corresponded with Davies. He's a brilliant British physicist, and he wrote a book a few years ago that was very similar in its perspective to mine. It was a book on the origin of life. I wrote a book before Darwin's Doubt called Signature in the Cell about the origin of the first life. And Davies also defines the central problem as the origin of, not just of complexity, but of informational complexity, the origin of all that code stored in the DNA molecule. And what he's talking about there is this new idea, is sometimes called self-organization, a complexifying principle. But no one seems to know what the complexifying principle is.
Or has been able to demonstrate it, or observe it, or anything.
Chemistry does not behave as the biologists need it to behave to explain the origin of life by reference to self-organizational chemical principles.
Isn't entropy the idea that things fall apart? That's more of an observable force.
That is more of an observable phenomenon. And as I show in Signature in the Cell as well, the forces of interaction between the parts of the DNA molecule don't account for the precise sequencing of the DNA molecule. It'd kind of be like saying the force of interaction between ink and paper is responsible for the information on the paper. No one's been able to demonstrate that. And so, yes, we need something to explain complexity, but the only thing we know based on experience that explains the kind of complexity we have in life, namely informational complexity, is, again, intelligence. Davies doesn't want to go there. He's not actually an advocate of intelligent design, but he's come very close to the water's edge.
Let's go to the water's edge. Well, Houston, Texas, not quite the water. You're on the Michael Medved Show. Bruce.
Yes, how are you today?
Very well indeed.
Good. Michael, I must say you look a lot better without the mustache.
Well, thank you. My wife thinks so, too, and that's the important thing.
And I would like to give Stephen Meyer a plug. I finished reading Darwin's Doubt, and I gave it to my wife, and she is a non-technical person. And I said, honey, think about this before we ever went to a first soccer game. We knew nothing about soccer, but getting there, seeing that there's 11 players on a team, it's on a field, there's two goals, and you just watch the game, you get a lot of information out of it. And reading this book, Darwin's Doubt, is the same thing. You don't have to be an expert on this stuff. Don't get confused by that. It's a fabulous book.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll say thank you for Steve. Go ahead.
Thank you very much.
All right. Now, just very quickly, infinity can be a single point, the center of a circle. Infinity can be a circle in that it has no beginning and end. Infinity can be the number pi that just goes on forever. Infinity can be a straight line that goes forever in any direction. Einstein said that E equals mc squared. Why couldn't it be that at the very, very beginning, energy, which has no mass, no volume, no time, congealed itself down into such a small point that literally the energy couldn't contain itself, and the explosion turned into the equivalent of energy, which is mass times velocity of light squared.
Okay, Stephen Meyer.
Well, obviously we're talking about some pretty heady stuff, and conceptualizing that first microsecond where we go from the singularity to a universe is really a hard thing to do. The current idea that physicists are entertaining to try to get around the problem that Michael and I were discussing before of the true singularity in time and space, where the infinite curvature of the universe would correspond to zero spatial volume, is this. It's called quantum cosmology. And the idea there is that the universe would exist as a kind of quantum field waiting to actualize all kinds of potential. But the problem with that new idea from the standpoint of strict materialism is that it really leaves unexplained the transition from a timeless state to a temporal state and the transition from an immaterial state to a material state. So there have been attempts to get around the problem that we were discussing, but they just raise deeper mysteries.
More deep mysteries coming up with Dr. Stephen Meyer. You can read his book, and I can assure you it's a lot more fun than soccer, at least in my opinion. It's called Darwin's Doubt. It's posted on our website at michaelmedved.com. We'll be right back.
Portions of the Michael Medved Show are brought to you in part by the Discovery Institute. To learn more, click on the Science and Culture banner at michaelmedved.com.
Minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Stephen Meyer. He is the author of the triumphant and very thought-provoking bestseller, Darwin's Doubt. It's posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. And when you go up to the website, you can find out information about joining us for a lunch and listen session a week from today, next Wednesday, at Discovery Institute in downtown Seattle. And if you happen to be visiting Seattle for the holidays, and Seattle's a great place to come during Christmas season, come join us at Discovery Institute from noon to 3. Sit in for the entire broadcast, and there will be delicious and, I am sure, seasonal refreshments that you can consume, but I can't because it's impolite to talk on the radio with your mouth full. Some of my colleagues do that occasionally, but we avoid it for the most part. Let's go quickly to Kevin in Everett, Washington. Kevin, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Stephen Meyer.
Hi, hey, I love the book. It's very persuasive. I'm just wondering, that's the second ID book I've read, and there's never any mention of the plant kingdom. Do the same issues and problems arise explaining plants? Are they just less complicated, or what's the story there?
Well, I'm more of an animal guy and a cell guy. So, we have a distinguished plant biologist who's prominent in the ID movement, a British biologist named Richard Buggs. And there are problems explaining the origin of plants. Plants are also more malleable because they hybridize easier. So, but there's a major event in the history of life called the angiosperm big bloom, where the flowering plants come suddenly into the fossil record, much like the first animals do in the Cambrian explosion. So, there are challenges to evolutionary theory.
That sounds like a great name for a rock group, the Angian Big Bloom.
The Big Bloomers.
Let's go to David in Detroit. David, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. Stephen Meyer.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I just had a question about how something comes from nothing and space-time. It takes energy to create matter, and it takes energy to create motion. Time is the product of the motion of matter. So you can't measure time until you have something, and then it moves, both of which energy creates. So before time existed, energy had to exist to create matter, and then it also put it in motion.
Okay, Stephen Meyer.
Well, I think your caller is contemplating some of the deep mysteries we mean to inspire. When you get into this area of cosmological reflection or theorizing, there's some really heavy questions that come up. And
some of those heavy questions, not all of them, addressed in Stephen's books, Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt. You can find out about both of them at our website at michaelmedved.com. Now, we haven't figured out what we're talking about in our live broadcast next week, Stephen, but I know that for our Science and Culture Hour, it will be sensational, informative, profound, and mind-bending. Exactly what you want for provocation and substance in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2013. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.